This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world development. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yais Wuhib. Coming up on Africa News Tonight,
what we're talking about is a practice which is steeped in tradition, steeped in history, and one which is really a global practice. We often tend to associate it with parts of sub-Saharan Africa, parts of the Middle East, but the reality is that today it's found just about all across the world.
That's Simon Ingram of UNICEF talking about female genital mutilation. Today is the International Day of Zero Tolerance for FGM. Details coming up.
Also, four men charged with spying for the Somali government are beheaded by Al-Shabaab militants. And Burundi's president has accused the former colonial ruler of Belgium of ethnically dividing the country.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story, Italy's Coast Guard says it rescued about 1,500 migrants from the Mediterranean Sea over the weekend. Meanwhile, Libya's government says it has blocked hundreds more migrants from leaving Libya over the weekend. Reporter Josephine McKenna updates us on the latest migrant developments and rescues.
It's a particularly high number, 1,500 migrants rescued in the Mediterranean when crossings tend to be very slow in the winter months because of the difficult sea conditions and strong winds and cold temperatures. But the Italian Coast Guard says 1,500 were rescued at the weekend, bringing to around 4,500 the total that have been saved just since last Wednesday. So that's really a large number of people making that crossing from Libya to Italy, and really another indication that we're not seeing any kind of slowdown in that mass migration from North Africa to Europe.
In the meantime, the Libyan government is claiming to have blocked hundreds of migrants from leaving Libya over the weekend as well.
Yes, that seems remarkable, but the Libyan Coast Guard says it stopped between 400 and 500 African migrants from attempting to reach Europe by blocking their passage from Libya. At the same time, however, 600 people were rescued at the weekend in separate rescues, mostly by the Italian Coast Guard. So they don't seem to be very effective in blocking this flow, and that's going to be particularly controversial given that the EU has signed an agreement hoping that Libya will be taking more action to indeed block this flow of migrants. And as we discussed before, the Europeans and the Italians want to invest more money in Libya to strengthen the Coast Guard, to strengthen security, and try and stop these migrants from making that passage to Italy.
And also, if you could just talk a little bit more about the strategy that was the main focus of the summit in Malta on Friday of breaking the business model of traffickers who are helping these African migrants to enter Italy through Libya.
The Italian government signed a bilateral agreement with Libya late last week and took that as a basis, as a strategy to the meeting of 28 European leaders meeting in Malta. They all agreed that more was needed to stop the flow of migrants. They want to break the power of the people traffickers. But there's been much written in the Italian media saying the big problem is corruption in the system in Libya, actually breaking down the power of the people smugglers who might be in bed with the lawmakers or in bed with those who are supposed to be stopping the flow of migrants makes this a very difficult problem. Now, today the Italian foreign minister said this is not a question of money. We will do everything possible to try and stop this flow of migrants. We want to support the Libyan institutions and make them more stable. We will help them in any way possible. But as we know, Libya is a divided country. There's great lawlessness there. There are questions about whether the government is strong enough to handle the people smuggling issue and really stop the flow of migrants, no matter how much European money is thrown at the Libyan government. This year, around 8,500 people have made desperate bids to reach Europe. They've been rescued at sea just since the beginning of the year, and more than 200 are either missing or feared dead. So we're still seeing this incredible flow coming across the Mediterranean, and so far we're not really seeing a sign of any kind of slowdown, and that's going to be very controversial if the European Union throws more money at the Libyan government to try and handle this problem.
That was reporter Josephine McKenna. She spoke with me from Rome.
In Somalia, Al-Shabaab militants have confirmed the beheadings of four men charged with spying for the government. The public execution took place yesterday after the men were found guilty by an Al-Shabaab court in the Jamam district of the lower Juba region. Al-Shabaab governor in the region says the men admitted they were spies and were executed in accordance with Sharia law. The Al-Qaeda-linked group carries out frequent attacks in the Somali capital. Last month, an attack on a hotel in the capital killed at least 28 people. The militant group is also known for its brutal punishments in the region, including floggings and amputations after being found guilty by a strict Islamic court. In related news, Somalia is scheduled to hold its presidential election this Wednesday, February 8th.
The United Nations is marking today as Zero Tolerance Day for FGM, or female genital mutilation. UNICEF, the UN Children's Fund, and the UN Population Fund say at least 200 million girls and women alive today have undergone some form of genital cutting. Most are in Africa, but it also affects women in Asia, Latin America, and some Arab states. Simon Ingram is a senior UNICEF spokesman. From Brussels, he spoke with VOA's Joe DiCapua.
What we're talking about is a practice which is steeped in tradition, steeped in history, and one which is really a global practice. We often tend to associate it with parts of sub-Saharan Africa, parts of the Middle East, but the reality is that today it's found just about all across the world. It has been exported just as it has been maintained within societies. It's a practice which, despite enormous amount or growing amount of attention and efforts to counter it over recent decades, has proved to be remarkably stubborn. And that's why progress has not been nearly as fast as we would have liked, and why it's necessary today, the day which speaks of the zero tolerance for FGM, it's why we're speaking out again.
And how widespread is it? I know there are about 200 million women and girls alive today who have undergone this procedure, but how widespread?
Well, it does vary enormously. There are some countries where the prevalence is extraordinarily high. Countries like Gambia, for example, where it's about 56%, we reckon, Mauritania, 54%, and it's pretty high in countries like Somalia and Djibouti as well. But the prevalence does differ sharply. In other countries, it's much more contained within small subsections of society. It's a very, very varied practice, many different explanations, many different cultures which practice it. It's very hard to generalize.
Why is it so hard to stop? Give me an example of some culture where this is ingrained and almost impossible to stop.
I think it's very important to understand that when parents, when communities speak about carrying out this practice on their young girls, they do it with the best possible intentions in mind. They do it because they see this is somehow purifying their girls, protecting them against instincts which would otherwise come to the surface and which would cause them problems, make them impossible to find partners in marriage, for example. It's something which communities really believe is for the best, and they cling on to it for that reason. So I, for example, have worked in Egypt, where FGM is a very deeply rooted practice, going way back beyond the time of Islam, for example. And there you can see the strength of the passion of feeling which is generated when communities start discussing this issue. I've seen practitioners or people who advocate against FGM going into communities and ending up in furious discussion and argument with some of the elders who say that they cannot possibly change a practice which goes back so far in time and which is so beneficial for their girls. So it is an issue which generates huge heat, and that makes it very, very difficult to convince people to change hearts and minds. That's what is needed in order to root out this practice once and for all.
Have you spoken to some of the young girls who've undergone this?
Absolutely. And there are some who are very proud of what's happened to them, some who believe that it was absolutely the right thing to do. They see this as a rite of passage, as it were. But at the same time, there are absolutely tragic stories which you hear about and encounter quite frequently. Girls who suffer terrible physical trauma, who are left physically and emotionally scarred for life. And there are even instances where girls, where something goes terribly wrong and it costs them their lives. So it is a practice which comes at a heavy price. And the tragedy is that although we are seeing success in terms of pushing back the practice in some countries, because of the rate of population growth in some of the larger countries where it's carried out, we risk seeing the practice becoming even more entrenched as time goes on. That's why efforts to root out FGM must be redoubled.
So what do you do when you say they need to be redoubled? How?
One is to do more to work with the health care workers and NGOs who are very active on the ground in many countries. We can work with national governments. In some countries, a change in the law is an important measure because it sends the signal that at the national level, at the government level, the FGM can no longer be tolerated. And I think we can also work with some of the people who've been brave enough to come out and say, FGM, that's something that I underwent, but it's something that I will never practice in future. These people need to be supported precisely because otherwise they become the target for criticism and attack by those who see their own interests as being undermined.
Simon Ingram is a senior UNICEF spokesman from Brussels. He spoke with VOA's Joe DiCapua. You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Hayes Wuhib, 17 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. 1,500 migrants are rescued from the Mediterranean Sea over the weekend. Four men charged with spying for the Somali government are beheaded by al-Shabaab militants. And the UN is marking today as Zero Tolerance Day for female genital mutilation. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
For years, UN mediation has failed to resolve the dispute between Morocco and the Polisario Front over the status of the Western Sahara. Following the decision by the Organization of African Unity in 1984 to admit the Sahara Arab Democratic Republic as a full member, Morocco pulled out of the organization. But last week, the African Union readmitted Morocco as a member. Mohamed Cherkawi is professor of conflict resolution at George Mason University. He spoke with VOA's Mohamed El-Shanawi about possible implications of that development on the future of the Western Sahara conflict.
Well, I think there was a significant shift, something I would call a new era of political pragmatism in African politics. So unlike those heated and sometimes tumultuous negotiations in the African way, we saw a smooth process of voting by two-thirds of the members to welcome back a leading African nation to the Union. So what I also appreciate in a positive way, that is the welcome gesture from the Polisario or the so-called Western Sahara Republic. And one of their officials said that Morocco's return to the African Union means that it would now be expected to put in practice decisions taken by the African Union with regard to a referendum in Western Sahara. So we also heard the Moroccan monarch who said in his speech in Addis Ababa the readmission was not meant to divide the continental body. For the first time, there is a consensus here that we need to move forward, and there is a serious search for a political resolution of the old conflict since 1975.
But the former Organization of African Unity recognized Western Sahara as a member, while most of its territories has been controlled by Morocco since 1976. Would the readmission of Morocco open the door to settle the Western Sahara dispute?
I think there is a strong growing conviction among African leaders, including North African ones, that the Western Sahara conflict should be handled regionally by some local diplomacy. So I think now what we'll see in the next few months probably is a shift from the UN in New York to the African Union in Addis Ababa to contemplate the idea or a formula for a working peace process, starting with the referendum that has been delayed since 1991. The conflict will put itself on the map of the continent more than the global, diplomacy. And it is also another strong dimension that would also stimulate this energy, which is the economic ties between various African nations. And apparently the Moroccan diplomacy has mixed diplomacy with the financial investments or opportunities. Since 2000, the Moroccan monarch has paid about 46, 47 visits to 25 different African countries and presided over the signature of 947 economic and diplomatic agreements. But I think 2017 is probably a wake-up call for African diplomacy to mitigate African conflicts.
Western Sahara's Foreign Minister Mohamed Ould Salek had earlier said progress on Morocco's admission to the African Union was a positive step since it would put them on an equal diplomatic footing. What's your take on that?
I think there is some recognition of political realism that we need to be engaged. This Moroccan return to the African Union without pushing or kicking the Polisario is an indicator of some good, positive engagement. And not only that, I heard that there will be a committee where both Moroccans and Sahrawis have to work together among other North African partners. So let's wait and see how this non-Cold War mindset will have the upper hand in bridging those differences and probably will pave the way for some middle way diplomacy and possible settlement after the long-standing stalemate in North Africa since 1975.
Mohamed Chakawi is professor of conflict resolution at George Mason University. He spoke with VOA's Mohamed El-Shanawi.
In Malawi, UNICEF is appealing for $22 million in emergency aid for children affected by El Niño. The UN agency estimates that 94% of children aged 6 to 24 months in Malawi do not have the minimum acceptable diet. That's largely because of food shortages, which have affected nearly half of the population. Andrew Brown is chief of communications at UNICEF Malawi. He told the reporter Lamek Masina the funds will be used to provide children with nutrition and health services.
This is part of a global appeal for $3.3 billion to cover our needs for children affected by natural disasters and conflict. Within this, there's a portion for Southern Africa, which is for countries affected by, first of all, El Nino and then La Nina, which is coming. In Malawi, we're asking for $22 million.
What's the extent of the problem in Malawi?
Well, at the moment, there are close to 1 million children affected by hunger in Malawi. We've seen over the last 2 years droughts, we've seen harvest failing. So a lot of families are now dependent on food aid. Although children are getting food, they're not getting the balanced diet that they need in order to survive and thrive.
How soon do you need the funds you are requesting here in this appeal?
We have immediate needs. So we have a 22 million funding gap right now. So we're appealing for the money now. I mean, this is a long-running situation, so the money will be welcome whenever we get it, but the needs are urgent and the needs are right now.
What will the funds be used for? Do you have the specific program where you will maybe invest the funds in?
Yes, so we have a program. The main focus of our program is treating malnutrition. Actually, at the moment, our latest statistics indicate that 94% of children age 6 to 24 months and not getting the minimum acceptable diet, which is a measure of diversity of food. We also know that around 45% of households have inadequate food consumption, so they don't have enough to eat.
What interventions are you currently doing in order to solve some of these malnutrition problems?
We currently have a mass screening program that we're running throughout Malawi. We have so far reached over 1 million children. And this involves going door to door through communities to look for children who are suffering from malnutrition. We can, for instance, measure the circumference of the arm. And by taking account of the child's age, we can see if they're suffering from malnutrition. If they are, we then have a program through health centres where children are assessed by a doctor. They are then prescribed, if they need it, ready-to-use therapeutic food. So this is, it's a paste, it's a little bit like peanut butter, but it's highly nutritious. The child gets a supply of that, and then they are monitored until their weight comes back up to a healthy weight. The parents would also be given counselling on how to ensure a balanced diet for the child.
How many have you screened?
So we've already screened over 1 million children throughout Malawi. We've also treated over 50,000. So of that 1 million, 50,000 children were identified as suffering from acute malnutrition. But we've estimated there's another 64,000 children that we need to treat this year.
Andrew Brown is Chief of Communication at UNICEF Malawi. He was talking to Lamek Masina in Blantyre. And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC.
For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of African News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Dan Crafton, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, Africa. This is James Brotty, host of Daybreak Africa, inviting you to join me every weekday morning at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC as we bring you the latest in African news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of Daybreak Africa through our listener mail segment by sending your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. You can also call us and leave us a voicemail at 202-205-9942. That's 202-205-9942. And when you hear the Voice of America identification, press the number 25 to leave us your message. Start your day with Daybreak Africa every weekday morning at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC on the Voice of America.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, an in-depth look at the northern Nigeria-based terrorist group Boko Haram. The militant group has targeted both Muslims and Christians, killing more than 20,000 people since 2009. VOA has exclusively obtained secret video shot by Boko Haram that identifies its operatives committing acts of terror. We'll discuss the violent organization on the next Straight Talk Africa at 18:30 UTC.
VOA News.
VOA. When news breaks, VOA News is there. Around the clock, listen to VOA Newscast at the top of each hour, along with our detailed news programs and analysis.
We are online at voanews.com.
VOA, your trusted source of news and information.